From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. On this special edition of the program, guest host Tatiana Voroshko, Senior Managing Editor in VOA's Ukrainian service, speaks with Peter Pomerantsev, a British journalist, author, and TV producer who specializes in Russian propaganda. Born in Kyiv when Ukraine was still under Soviet rule, Peter lived and worked in Moscow between 2001 and 2010, where he produced programs on the Russian entertainment channel TNT. In 2011, Peter Pomerantsev began writing about Russia and is credited for describing Vladimir Putin's regime as a, quote, postmodern dictatorship. In this captivating interview with Tatiana Voroshko, he contextualizes Russia's unprovoked invasion of Ukraine within Russian imperial history, as well as compares Russia's use of propaganda to that of Nazi Germany's during World War II. My colleague Tatiana Voroshko asks Peter what he thinks of framing Russia's war on Ukraine as Putin's war.
In the West, they often call the war Putin's war. What do you think about this terminology?
As opposed to Russia's war, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, I know there's a lot of controversy about this in Ukraine. It's the war of the Russian state against the Ukrainian state, so it's Russia's war. But I suppose what people mean by that is that it is the expression of centuries of Russian culture. Culture in the sense of ideas, language, education, art. And that is a long tradition from anecdotes that look down on Ukrainians through to high-end literature, which delegitimizes Ukrainian claims to nationhood. And so really what we're seeing now is not just a war that started right now, but really an expression of Russian imperialist culture. Culture in the sense of the expression of all of a society's ideas and thoughts. And I think that's a very, very justified case. This is not the first Russian invasion of Ukraine. It's something that is deeply embedded within Russian political culture, artistic culture, educational culture, common culture. And in many ways, this is the latest iteration. So you could say that Putin's invasion of Ukraine is the latest iteration of Russia's war with Ukraine or against Ukraine. So I understand why people fight for that. And, you know, this is not an accidental conflict. This is a conflict that is deeply embedded in Russia's imperial political psychology.
I think what Ukrainians also mean by that is that how much responsibility regular Russians are going to carry for the war?
So the question of collective responsibility is a very, very complicated one. What year are we in now? 2022? You know, we're almost like 75 years after the Second World War. We are still debating whether Germans, ordinary Germans, at that time, bear responsibility for the Holocaust. So these sort of debates about collective responsibility, they seem endless. They go on and on and on and on. What I do know is that on a very personal level, the Russians that I know who have taken a political position, they do feel responsible. They feel deeply responsible and deeply ashamed. They also feel impotent, and we can talk about that sense of impotence, but they do feel deeply responsible. While the ones who have stayed will always shrug off responsibility. So one of the coping mechanisms people have is to say, "Я тут ни при чем. It's a dictatorship. I've got nothing to do with this." While the people who feel responsibility are also the ones who want to do something active. They don't always know how to. They haven't found a way to do it, frankly, but at least they think about it. So I wonder whether responsibility is deeply connected with the sense of having a self. To say that I have responsibility is to have quite a high regard for yourself. Guilt and responsibility are deeply connected to a sense of agency. So I think it's actually almost a symptom of the way people have been crushed or agreed to have been crushed by the system in Russia that they refuse to take on responsibility. It's deeply connected. But that's looking at it from the point of view of sort of the individual. When does an individual feel responsible? It's when they feel they have a sense of agency. So the collective responsibility question is one that is sort of like, it hasn't been resolved around Germany for 70 years. So it's a very, very long question to get into.
But it's not only the sense of responsibility, but also Ukrainians kind of shocked is the lack of empathy.
I'm surprised by the surprise. So Vladimir Putin was elected in 2000 on the back of a murderous war in Chechnya, which whatever you may think of the background and the reasons for it was based upon the principle of bombing civilians. He had success in Syria by massively destroying civilian populations. This is the Russian way of war. This is not a society that holds any kind of worth to human life. I don't see why people are surprised. I lived in Russia for 9 years between 2001 and 2010. It's an utterly callous society. So I'm not surprised at all.
We know the example for Rwanda. They were high-level executives which were brought to justice. They had hefty prison terms or even life terms. Is something possible in the case with Russia?
There is some track record of propagandists being found guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity. I don't think the Rwandan example is a very useful one. Rwanda, literally, you have people saying, go to this church and make sure more people die. It's a direct instruction. That very rarely happens. Interesting looking at the case of Nuremberg and the Nazis. One of the chief propagandists is found guilty, Julius Streicher. He's the editor of the most anti-Semitic magazine, but he's also the Gauleiter of Nuremberg. He's also a Nazi decision maker. He's found guilty, both for incitement, but also because he was part of inner organization of the party. Hans Fritzsche, head of the Reichsradio, on air every evening, giving anti-Semitic speeches, found not guilty. Very, very quickly found not guilty. One of the quickest cases. Because the argument is he's given a piece of paper and he reads it. Who the hell is he? And I think that is interesting, because what you have to show is that the propagandists are aware that they are part of military operations that commit war crimes or domestic operations that lead to arrests and murder inside of Russia. You have to show they're aware of it, that they're part of the system, that they have a choice. So those are things you'd have to show. I think they're perfectly showable. I think that anybody working in the Russian media post February 24th has to be aware that what they're doing is part of an integrated military operation leading to war crimes, crimes against humanity, war of aggression, perhaps intent to genocide. There's just no way you're not aware of it anymore. People have left because they don't want to be part of it. So you'd have to show that. You'd have to show people are aware. You'd have to show it's integrated. It's not just words. Genocidal rhetoric is not the same as intent to genocide. Words are not enough. You'd have to show that the words are part of a system that prepares military operations. So the example that's often used, we would want to look at a case study like the bombing of the hospital in Mariupol. But weeks before that, there's Russian propaganda saying there are Nazi Ukrainian fighters in this hospital. Disinformation leading to the enabling of a war crime. Simply saying nasty things is not criminal. So you'd have to show that they are part of a machine. But they are part of a machine. We know they're part of a machine. We know that the Russian media is integrated into state mechanisms. And I think you'd start with showing domestic repressions as well. You'd show how the media is used to go after opponents of the government inside Russia, how that leads to their arrests, how that leads to their beatings, sometimes their murder. So you have to show the history of it. Look, it starts with domestic, then it moves on to foreign. This is a machine and it works together. They will, of course, say, we had no idea. We just say things. We're just given pieces of paper to read, or we are just giving opinion. You'd have to show it's more than opinion. I think that's easier today than it was during the Nazi times, because now you can show how something starts as words on TV, becomes an online coordinated campaign that leads up to a military operation. I think you can show the system in much more granularity than you used to. So I think there is a chance. I'm not a lawyer, but I have spoken to lawyers who think there is a reasonable case to be made.
It doesn't have to be legal culpability. There's one, in, like, I know that Christa Grozev came to the Washington talking about sanctions.
So without a doubt, the sanctions at the moment are only against the elites, which is not serious. There should be sanctions against anybody working in state institutions or institutions that are somehow linked to the war. That involves PR companies, that involves TV companies which are nominally private but are actually part of the state. So anybody involved in the war machine, all the way through those companies, should be sanctioned. Whenever I advocate for this, and I'm not the only one, many, many people advocate for this, we're always told, but who's going to put together the lists? That's so much work. Who's going to get the lists? Oh, God, we'll never manage it. Who's going to enforce it? That's the excuse. No one has ever argued that it's wrong. The argument that I hear is that it'll be hard to enforce and we just don't have the capacity to do it.
I'm sure there'll be plenty of people happy to put the list together.
Imagine it's people putting it together. You get the wrong person, they sue, it's a disaster. No, 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 I understand it's a legal process. You get it wrong, you get human rights lawyers going against your government. So no, it is tricky, but like it's cheaper than many other things that we're doing to stop Russia.
And one of the things you're doing, it's like a reckoning project. Can you say a few words about it and the purpose of it?
The purpose of the reckoning project is to fight for truth, accountability and memory around war crimes in Ukraine. So we face this very strange moment where the Kremlin isn't just militarily attacking Ukraine. It's trying to claim that it can murder with impunity and get away with it. As we sit here, there are bulldozers going through Mariupol, cleaning up the rubble of buildings the Russians destroyed while there are corpses within it. Those lives and the memory of those lives and the memory of their livelihoods in those places, the Kremlin is literally sweeping them away. We talk about Bucha and places, and Bucha at least was liberated. What about the non-liberated places? They're just destroying the social fabric, destroying the memory, and saying we can recreate reality. So that has to be fought for on the level of war crimes, obviously, but also in terms of storytelling and memory and telling the story of these people and making sure that the Kremlin doesn't get away with just obliterating the past, as they have many times before. So that's what we fight for. And in order to do that, we kind of put together the talents of lawyers and journalists. So we have journalists throughout the country who are collecting evidence, consulting with lawyers to make sure that they collect evidence so it's good enough for law courts, but then also telling long-form stories around it. So we're fighting for sort of justice both in law courts and the courts of public opinion. Often, journalists of lawyers have actually been either competing with each other or getting in each other's way or at loggerheads. So often the way, sadly, journalists collect material means that lawyers then can't talk to the people they've talked to because they've done it in such an unethical way. Sorry, journalists, asking leading questions, re-traumatizing people, that anything that person then says is inadmissible in court. So that's problematic. So we're trying to make sure that as journalists who are heroic in being often the first people at a war crime, as they're doing their journalistic work, nothing's changing in their journalistic work. As they do it, they make sure they don't do it in a way that makes it harder for lawyers to work afterwards, but also so they can hand their notebooks onto, of course. It just comes out of the bitter experience of Yugoslavia and many other places where all the evidence that journalists collected were then inadmissible in court. So at the very simple level, it's that. And then it's just building that up and up and up and up so that material then gets fed to the law courts, but then we're also creating stories around it. So that's the basic idea. But I think on a sort of philosophical level, I suppose, the idea is to push back against this sort of mass disinformation. You need mass evidence collection and mass production of stories in order to counterbalance. Because already the Kremlin is trying to undermine the truth of what happened in Bucha, for example. You know, they're trying to seed doubt already. And we're thinking 5 years from now, 10 years from now, how do we ensure the memory of what has happened now also has prominence and centrality? And I'm very worried about the online dynamic. Back in the day, something terrible happened. You would build a museum in the center of the city to commemorate the Holocaust or the Holodomor. What happens in the city of the internet? You know, how do we make sure that online, everything that is happening now remains central and prominent and that memory is stable? Because you could see it just coming apart. How do we keep it in the middle? How do we make sure that this stays? I think that's a challenge we haven't really got to grips with.
One of the central topics of your latest book, This Is No Propaganda, is that in Russian society, the claim is that reality does not exist, no objective reality, everyone has its own reality. And what's the reasons for that and how dangerous it is?
By saying there's no reality, you're also saying there's no good and bad. You know, they're saying that everything is relative. There's no sort of dignified individual who has a right to a share in reality. You know, negotiating reality, ceding reality to others is sort of the nature of democracy. What they're saying is the powerful get to decide everything. There is no evidence you can present in your defense because truth is a subset of power. That's what they're saying. And if you're powerful, you can manipulate the truth and you can define the truth. That's what they're saying. And I think they're trying to prove it in Ukraine. Trying to show we can murder with impunity, we can remake borders with impunity, we can obliterate lives with impunity, we can reinvent who you are, and because we're stronger than you, we have the right to do it. What I'm interested in is propaganda. That's the one thing that I look at semi-academically. And what Russian propaganda reveals is the psychological architecture that fascist propaganda also shared, that actually all extremist propaganda shares. It's almost like it's like they reveal the naked psychological skeleton underneath. But it's stripped of the ideology, it's stripped of maybe some of the language, but not the structures of language. And it's just left that underlying psychological mechanism, which it shares completely with the Nazis. And I find that very interesting. I find generally propaganda is moving to the pure psychological state. We're stripping away ideology more and more and more. Even things like ISIS, which felt as if they might have ideology, and they do have quite a lot of Islamist ideology, at the end of the day, it was just the pure psychological pressure cooker. So I find looking at Nazi propaganda actually a very useful way to understand what the Russians are doing. It taps into the same psychological needs. It taps into the same psychological vulnerabilities. It taps into very, very similar sicknesses and pathologies within family structures, which are very, very important here. The cult of the abusive father, etc., etc., etc. So I see a lot of similarities. There are obvious differences, but something underneath a sadomasochistic cycle, which psychoanalysts identified in Nazi propaganda, is very, very elemental to Putin's propaganda as well.
Do they even have ideology? Like, it's hard to define.
Ideology can play a role, but it's not a thick role. It's a garnish. If it was cooking, you know, like, yeah, they throw some parsley on. The ideology is the parsley on top. But look, they've already had like 7 reasons for invading Ukraine. Denazification, then it was NATO, then it was Peter the Great. I mean, it's constantly changing, like a chef who's changing the dish. But something like Russian world is very interesting. What do they mean? The borders are completely amorphous. The meaning is amorphous. It is just this state of wanting more, of being endlessly unsatisfied and unsatisfiable. So the most interesting analysis of Lebensraum, the Russian world reminds me a lot of the Nazi Lebensraum, was by an English psychoanalyst called Henry Dix, who actually did a very scientific analysis of Nazi soldiers who were POWs. There were thousands of them. He got to do really deep interviews with them in 44 and 45, an incredible snapshot of the Nazi mind. And he found the ones who really believed in Nazism, which were only around 30% of German soldiers, 30% were hardcore Nazis. They mostly came from families with abusive fathers, very distant fathers, bizarre kind of idealization of their mothers. But basically, they'd been very, very neglected as children, and that had been compensated with what he called secondary narcissism. Not normal narcissism, which is just rational self-interest, but this endless desire for more, which is unquenchable and deeply self-destructive. And he saw the Lebensraum as the articulation of these psychological needs. You know, these are deeply, deeply, deeply damaged people who are always unsatisfied. And they express that through the Lebensraum. Lebensraum is this desire for more, more, more. And there's a lot of sadism that goes with that. And so the Russian world is really about that. It's this sort of unquestionable desire for more among certainly a segment of society from very unhealthy families, but really a whole society that has always been humiliated by its rulers. The desire for a tsar with a strong hand who should punish us. I mean, this is a very, very masochistic language, and then which is constantly trying to sort of reach out for more territory, more possession, more conquering to compensate for this sort of elemental lack. So I think the Lebensraum and the Russian world have a lot in common.
You are listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Guest host Tatiana Voroshko is speaking with Ukrainian-born British journalist and author Peter Pomerantsev, an expert in Russian propaganda. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voaafrica.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter at @Carol_Castiel or connect with us on Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Well, here's a shout out to a new listener and Facebook follower, Anderson Alves from the northeastern state of Ceará in Brazil. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Now back to host Tatiana Voroshko's interview with Peter Pomerantsev.
Russian government, especially, I would say, Sergei Lavrov, they talk about Russophobia. They explain sanctions or any actions and some sort of people don't like Russians by some reason. Is it like a propaganda play or they don't really understand the connection between action and the attitude towards them?
Everything they do is propaganda. I mean, they fundamentally see the public sphere as something that is a space for manipulation. And that's deeply expressed in all Russian discourse, both among ordinary people and Lavrov. Everything is manipulation. Everything is a game. There is no reality to argue about. There's only just using information as a way to manipulate others. So everything they say is always a game because that's their worldview. No, the Russophobia thing is a way of like building a siege mentality in Russia. In general, in Russia, there's a problem with cause and effect. It's a sign of very sick societies when people don't understand how things fit together. Why are they all fighting us? Because you started a war. It's broken all the time. Sort of semi-mystical sort of like thing. Like, oh, the sanctions came down from somewhere. Like, you know, the inflation came from somewhere. So instead of having a detailed analysis of why things happen in society, which would mean confronting a lot of internal demons in Russia, I mean, that might be one of the reasons people don't want to think about these things. You have kind of conspiracy, which explains everything away. Oh, it's because there's a conspiracy against Russia. So I suppose it makes things easier for people to cope with, this sort of pseudo explanation of the world. But, it, you know, it helps rally around the flag. It helps sort of unite society. And maybe it works. So maybe as stupid as it sounds to us, maybe it's quite effective.
Ukrainian historians explain a lot by the fact that Russians don't know the history. They didn't even attempt to learn what really happened in the past. There's a lot of mythology, there's a lot of appropriation of part of Ukrainian history, stuff like that. Do you agree with that? And if it's so, how can you make Russians confront their past?
So I completely agree. Usually that happens after a huge loss. First, you win on the battlefield, then you firebomb their cities and crush them, and then they start analyzing themselves. I mean, that's the Second World War example. In Germany and Japan, it happens after the Second World War. I suppose in Germany, what you have is a kind of concurrently during the war, you still have this kind of oasis, which is given shelter on the BBC and in various American universities for German dissidents to start confronting these questions. I mean, Thomas Mann, most famously, giving speeches on the BBC all the time about how Germany needs to come to terms with itself. So I suppose you could start already preparing the language and the thinking. There are ideas about creating an independent Russian language university in the Baltics that would start doing this work, laying the ground for a future, which one day will or won't happen. I actually wonder whether you could actually start some of these things now inside of Russia as well. That would mean before you get to the point of actually confronting the past is creating a language and a mental space that is even prepared to self-analyze. So if I had power over Voice of America, which you do, I don't, I would invest very heavily in proper psychological programs, just talk shows, where Russians would start talking about the psychological issues they're facing. And they're facing a lot. We know from the statistics that mental health issues have skyrocketed since February. Start talking about them publicly and then start connecting them to why the hell this is happening. There's a lot of people turning up at psychiatrists and at hospitals in Moscow, for example, saying, give me Prozac, give me pills, I feel awful. And, you know, the doctors are always like asking them, so when did it start? And they're like, February 24th. Okay, we can't talk about that. So, like, people can't talk about the roots of their issues. So maybe you start with that. You start creating that analytical space where that can happen. And then you start talking about the deeper stuff in society, you know. But we're talking about unearthing centuries or at least decades of trauma where people are often both victims and torturers, which is what makes it so difficult. It's not just a victimhood position. Pretty quickly, you have to admit that you're part of the system, that you benefited from the system, that you ignored the bad sides of the system. And historically, you probably did that a lot. I mean, it is still a society where people were both victims of the gulag and the perpetrators of it, and then the perpetrators of crimes against the colonial subjects. So that's a lot of unpacking to do. But maybe we can start creating the language and the space for that to happen. But this is slow work. I mean, this will not sort of change anything overnight. Ukraine has done huge work in this sense by making the Holodomor a clear story. It's a classic case of cultural trauma. You know, you unearth the pain, you decide who's responsible, you create memorials to it, and then you move on. The point of cultural trauma is moving on. And Ukraine has done huge work that way. Russia has done nothing similar, hasn't even tried. So it's a pretty long process.
But it still finds some response in other countries. There are still pro-Russian, Russophile attitudes in Latin America, in Africa, even among far-right, progressive, very, very left. So how do they sell? Why do they find this response?
So I don't know to what extent they're pro-Russian, frankly. I think Russia and a lot of these places has traditionally been seen as a balance against America and maybe China. Maybe there is still some legacy of Soviet propaganda where Russia was the anti-colonial power. So if your main enemy historically is Britain or America, you know, Russia is seen as someone who checks that. I don't think there's a huge mystery to it. I suspect nowadays these relationships are far more transactional than we think and that actually they can be moved. It's very interesting going to Hungary recently, because Hungary is obviously Russia's biggest backer in Europe. They're not pro-Russian. They have very bad memories of Russia from 56. They fear Russia. And they have this doctrine of survival, of Hungarian survival, where they have to balance off the great powers against each other and play them off. So they think it's in the interest of their survival to use Russia as a lever to push back against others. That's the way that Hungary stays safe. So it's very transactional. And I think the more that we can reveal that Russia is not a strong power that you can use to balance off other powers, that Russia is toxic, chaotic, self-destructive, and a pariah. And the more that you can communicate that to countries that have invested in Russia and that Russia has invested in, the more that perception can shift. Beyond the sort of legacy of Soviet propaganda, I think there's something very, very hard and transactional there. And I think the calculations of that transaction can change.
I find the most surprising with Africa, because if you think about it, Ukraine is engaged in an anti-colonial war with the power that abolished slavery only 4 years before the United States. And also Ukraine is a big exporter of food products and a destination for students from Africa. You would think that Africans would be cheering for Ukraine, but it doesn't happen.
So again, I think there's different countries and there's different dynamics, and I wouldn't put all of Africa in one box, but I think there seems to be some buying into the narrative that this has nothing to do with Ukraine. This is America and Britain, the evil colonial powers expanding their NATO empire. Ukraine doesn't exist as a subject for them. So that secrets some thoughts that this is about Ukraine fighting, they would dismiss straight away. But I think there is possibility for Ukraine to build connections around post-colonial narratives. I think that can probably be done through sort of writers and through sort of intellectual elites, maybe, first of all, who can help those things. I'd love to see Ukrainian writers turning up in literary festivals in Latin America and in India and other places. Again, I think all this is in play, but important as it is to promote the Ukrainian voice, also very important to really surface the reality of Russia as a very, very useless friend. Putin worked very hard to promote Russia as a ruthless supporter of authoritarian regimes. A lot of the regimes we're talking about are not nice regimes, by the way, that support Russia. And Putin has done a lot to say, we will support you. We will give you nuclear power stations and Wagner mercenary groups and political technologists, and we'll give you all of that if you support us. And the more you show that actually Russia is an unreliable partner, I think that'll be quite important as well.
But also, there's a big change in how the world perceives Ukraine. If you kind of summarize where Ukraine was in January and where Ukraine is right now in the eyes of the world, first of all in the West.
Yeah, the world has many eyes. So I think there's been a growing awareness of what Ukraine is since 2014. Certainly, when I used to say that I was born in Kyiv, it used to be, is that in Russia? So that has moved on. But I think now it's turned into the hero nation. And it's very interesting to see this transformation. And I think we need a lot of real studies to work out how that happened, because it happened very, very quickly. And there's a lot of accidental things, Zelensky being president and being a remarkable communicator. The sheer evilness of Putin's face, which just is like a caricature of a bad guy in a movie. He's every bully you've ever known. I think, you know, at the end of the day, people just see two close-ups. Zelensky, who looks very, very human, and Putin, who's always looked vile, but now looks, it's just a seething anger. And he's every bully you've ever known. He's every predator you've ever known. He's every awful boss you've ever known. I mean, people just, normal people don't need international relations analysis. They just see the truth. Ordinary people are often much better than professors of international relations at understanding what's going on. That Ukrainians are clearly fighting as a family together. It's an all of society thing that has inspired people a lot. In a very atomized world, maybe very atomized after the COVID epidemic, suddenly seeing a society pull together. The granny, the uncle, the soldier, the teacher, everybody working together was such something we lack so much in our broken apart societies. And also I think the way Ukraine broke through this huge debate in the West, which was a fake debate between patriots and globalists. This has been the attempt to say this. Two different types of person in the world. People who believe in liberal democracy and people who are patriotic. And Ukraine showed that that's a fake division. Ukraine is fighting both for democracy and for human rights and for patriotism, sovereignty. And it's so obviously fighting for both, and it articulates that it's fighting for both. And Ukraine just suddenly cut across this fake divide in Western society, and everyone's like, oh, wow, there are bigger things than these idiotic debates that we've got stuck into. And 75% of Americans back Ukraine? I mean, you do wonder about the 25%. But come on, 75% of Americans agreeing on anything? That's the first time since September the 11th there's any consensus in this country. So that's remarkable. Even in Germany, which has always had a soft spot for Russia, overarching consensus. So I think Ukraine just reminded people suddenly of these sort of much, much deeper values of community, of civil society, of patriotism, of why you fight for democracy. And it made all these empty words real again. And that's incredibly powerful. That isn't, however, a policy. How you move from sympathy to long-term policy. So far, we're doing three-month policy. There isn't yet a strategic policy. But again, I think the people are ahead of the politicians.
We kind of discussed everyone likes Ukraine, Russia is a useless friend, they have nothing to sell. Are they still powerful in the disinformation? Do we still have to worry about it or just wait till the war is over and just help Ukraine to win the war?
So the kind of tactical disinformation, I don't know how far that's getting, the sort of trying to subvert the truth of war crimes in Ukraine. I mean, that's happening online. You have these pockets of people online who say Bucha was staged. I don't think that's very important. In terms of overall propaganda and information games, the Russians have clearly lost hugely in a lot of the assets they invested into, in Germany, in parts of Central Europe, I think even in America. However, there are larger information and perception games the Russians are playing, which are doing very well. So the use of nuclear threats, nuclear blackmail, grain blackmail, energy blackmail. They're into like these big games. They're not into like piddly little disinformation campaigns on Twitter. Like no one cares about that anymore. That was like the cartoons. Now we're into sort of the big mind games. Will they use nuclear weapons? What will be the effect of their using food as a way to blackmail the world? Who will that be blamed on? This is all about perception. This is all about information. So I'm less worried in the West about these sort of like alarming but third tier campaigns on Facebook. I'm very worried about these larger narratives. We're into the big propaganda games, not into the little stuff. And are they winning there? They're not winning as much as they would like to, but they're definitely setting the agenda. They're often setting the framing. You have the richest man in America with 122 million followers on Twitter, who now owns Twitter, repeating Russian framings every day, sabotaging Starlink so that Ukrainian military can't do their operation. So that's pretty worrying.
That was British journalist and author Peter Pomerantsev speaking with senior managing editor of VOA's Ukrainian service, Tatiana Voroshko. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was edited and produced in Washington. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.